I want to welcome everyone here this afternoon. And this is a subject for today is emptiness. Or it's a special interest to people at this time, because of the time of abundance, then we begin to realize the futility and the meaninglessness of so many things. I think if you could stop your camera for a while. You're all right. It gets unnerving to have a lot of cameras focused on you. I think I'm a Korean War veteran, so I get nervous when they have things aimed at me all the time. I think that the hallmark really of Buddhism is the fact that it does emphasize significant words are like, let's say, the most famous significant word is Nibbana or Nirvana, which gets translated into pop jargon by being kind of maybe wonderful or heavenly. And somebody showed me some wool the other day named Nirvana, and it's used, you know, for in Perth, Australia, there's a woman's hair salon named Nirvana. And I'm sure this doesn't mean emptiness, or maybe it's a place for shaving women's heads. I don't know. I assume that it really meant to imply the kind of, the best, the most beautiful. And so heaven and hell are the kind of polarization of conditionality, where heaven symbolizes the very best that you can possibly think of on the conditioned plane. And hell is the absolute worst of what you can imagine in terms of pain, misery, disgusting conditions, horrible conditions. And Nibbana means the letting go or the non-attachment to the extreme. So it's not a state of refined bliss and extreme happiness, but it's a different kind of experience where you realize letting go and non-attachment. Where before we realize that, then our experience of life is just through attachment. We're just attached, and we experience life through our ideas, our views, our the sense of ourself, our cultural attitudes and social conditioning, our fears and desires. So say the average person that has not realized Nibbana then experiences life through the conditions that they acquire, that they attach to. And then the realization of Nibbana is the realization of non-attachment to the conditions. It's a subtle realization, and a realization isn't a created thing. Is it? You don't create conditions refined and subtle and beautiful conditions for Nibbana. It's not that. It's not not dependent on the conditions of the present moment, but the response to the conditions of the moment. So in say, a person with a horrible pain, terrible diseases, in the midst of the battlefield, and say all the conditions are absolutely rotten, but they could still realize nibbana. Then in Theravada they emphasize anatta or no self, which isn't a, this is also a term that oftentimes gets overused and becomes a kind of atheistic belief that Theravadan Buddhists can grasp. I've heard people say, we believe in anatta or no self, which is not what the Buddha meant. It's not a position one takes, but it also is a realization. Through meditation, you're actually looking and observing how things are. And through that investigation of what you usually regard as yourself, you realize it's not yourself. Because our personalities and our ego is very much conditioned by identification with your body, with the gender, with your male or female, with what you look like, color of your hair, color of your eyes, the shape of your nose, the complexion you have. And so we identify with our bodies, with our face especially. And then we say, this is this. I am a man. I am a white man. I am an old man or young man, or whatever. But these, when we look into these perceptions of self, we realize they're just conditions of the mind. That this body is a condition of in nature. It's not like my personal possession. This physical body operates according to the laws of nature. It doesn't operate according to the way I want it to. Unless what I want is in line with nature's ways. So you can see that modern life is an attempt to try to control the body, make it, because we're so strongly identified with it, make it do what we want, make it look what we think it should look like, and be happy or miserable according to what it looks like and the praise or the blame that it receives. Interesting, just to observe the force of will, what Olympic athletes can make their bodies do, isn't it? Incredible. Well, just an act of will, you can make your body do, say, incredible things in terms of human experience. I even heard singers or opera singers who can visualize in their mind high notes and will themselves to reach incredibly high pitches that are beyond their ordinary range, just through an act of will. And so the human mind, we're very willful creatures, and we can imagine extremes that are beyond, say, the limits of our own physical abilities, and we can make ourselves do those sometimes. But then in the long run, it's not sustainable, is it? You can't sustain that kind of extremity that's very brief, and then oftentimes you can't ever do it again. So in terms of anatta or no self, then we've seen that these are just using our willpower and trying to control and dominate our life's experiences is based on our attachment to desire and fear, and that we create our endless suffering around all these things that we're attached to, which is what our personality is, comes from. And that we consider ourselves whether we're as good as somebody else, we're superior or inferior or the same. I mean, endless projections and anxieties we have about ourselves as a physical being. Then our emotions and views and opinions, the way we attach to these, create a sense of a person. I am a unique personality. But on investigation, it doesn't hold up when you really... And this you must do yourself. You must find out. Not asking you to believe in anatta. But it is a word that encourages us to look at all the things we assume we are. The views, the opinions, the way it is, the conditioning of your mind, your own body, as it is. And see whether you can find anything that you can honestly regard as an eternal, ongoing, unmitigated self that lasts through lifetimes or eternity. Then shunyata, or emptiness. This also in Theravada is mentioned a lot, but in Mahayana, the Madhyamika teachings and so forth, in Zen, of course, Zen, various forms of Zen Buddhism emphasize emptiness. Then there's nothingness, and then there's desirelessness and cessation. So these words are very significant in Buddhism. And they're negations of things, aren't they? They're like anatta is a negation of self. Nibbana means not, actually it means the realization of non-attachment. It doesn't tell you what it really is. It's not a description of something, but it's a denying of a common habit that we have, which is attachment. Shunyata doesn't say whether emptiness is good or bad or anything. It's just empty. It's like space, like nothing. And so when we try to conceive, try to just attach to these ideas of no self, emptiness, nibbana, nirodha, desirelessness, we end up through just holding on to the views that we form around these words. What happens is we become annihilationists. So you meet Buddhists who believe there's no God, no self, there's no meaning, there's no soul. And they come, their view is one of a very, it's based on the intellect, on grasping the ideas of anatta and nirodha and nibbana and shunyata. So the logic, when you logically deduct from that, then it's annihilationism or nihilism. You end up as you're saying it's meaningless, there's nothing, it's just totally empty. And that ends up as a position you take and grasp that position, which is what the Buddha was trying to point to as the cause of suffering. Whether you believe we have a soul, believe in God, believe in eternal heaven, and believe in... I mean, if you're going to believe in things, it's better to believe in the positive side. It makes you happy, at least. So the belief in a loving God that... heaven, eternal heaven, things. These are very inspiring and beautiful beliefs. And then the other, no God, no self, tends to come across as a really, sour grapes approach to life, and a real put down of everything. So those are the two extremes. The Buddha, he's pointing to the middle way between what he called Gamma Sukhalekana Yoga, which is the eternalist view, and Attakilamatana Yoga, which is the annihilationist view. And so it's just very important to recognize these two extreme views in terms of our thoughts, opinions that we have, assumptions that we make about ourselves and the universe that we live in, that we're experiencing now. And so the emptiness, realization of emptiness or anatta, is done not through trying to grasp the idea, but through the actual realization of it, the reality, the direct knowing of the simple experience of non-attachment. In the Buddhist monastic form, for example, the bhikkhu, it's a form that tends to encourage this realization. The attempt to shave the head and the eyebrows, the beard, the mustache, all the kind of highly the signs that convey you are a man or a woman on the level of what your face and your appearance are removed. You notice the Siladharas, they shave their head and eyebrows, their beards and mustaches. So do we. And then we all you can still tell male and female, but there's no emphasis on that. Not to promote that sense of identification with gender. Or the robe, the kind of shapeless, the robe that covers the body does not conform to the lines in a way that exaggerate the female or male form. Things like this, the color itself is an unattractive color. Isn't it? It's not this color they don't use in fashion, hardly ever. And when they do, it doesn't last very long. And people don't like this color very much. So it's a kind of mucky color. And so that it doesn't arouse a kind of sexual interest and convey a sense of look at me and make how attractive I am. So that these are just ways, conventional ways, say, of contemplating, of reflecting our own sense of ourself as a male, as a female, as being attractive or unattractive or whatever. It isn't a denial or a rejection of femininity or masculinity, but it's a mirror for that, because those are very strong identities. Then the discipline and the whole structure is based on reflecting, observing your own kind of egotistical obsessions with yourself and the selfish attitudes, because you're living in community. Your selfishness is reflected a lot in communal life. In a community, everybody has to kind of work together. We have to help each other, and a really selfish person stands out like a sore thumb in a monastic community. Well, they might go fairly unnoticed if they're living in their own flat in London, and then nobody might know that they're selfish at all. And they might not even know. You really find out when you join the monastic community how selfish you are. So the sense of self is brought up into consciousness. And now we are conscious beings. So this is consciousness is a function. It's not a we don't identify on the ego from the ego or the personality with consciousness. The personality is around our feelings and our opinions, isn't it? You create yourself out of views and opinions and your feelings. What you like, what you don't like, your view about yourself and the world, and the cultural attitudes and the fashions of the day, and all this can give us a sense of our self-worth as a person. It's interesting. I've said this several times before, but just to use an example of a highly of a mere reflection for a sense of self was myself being American, conditioned in a way that where the self is very strong. Your identities are very much with being an individual. My generation and social background in the States was one based on asserting yourself as an individual. Your value was your individuality, not your class, not your race, not your anything other than the sense of your self-importance as an individual compared to others. It's a very competitive system. So you have a, even though it's an egalitarian, idealistic society, it's also very competitive. So you even though you say on one level you're saying we're all equal, we're all the same. There's no class. Everybody's equal here. Men, women, all races. And on the ideal level, that's proclaimed as the way it should be. But in the realities of life, we're always trying to prove we're better than somebody else. And so you're feeling inferior. If you're not better, then you tend to see it's hard to sustain an ongoing view of yourself as equal when it gets highly personal, isn't it? It becomes you're better than I am, or I'm not as good as you are, I'm better than you are. You're much more stupid than I am, or I'm much more stupid than you are. And so this sense of individuality was my cultural conditioning, highly developed sense of a unique self-importance, and because of that, there was a lack of ease in life, because this was such a basic underlying assumption. It wasn't like given to me in a direct way. It was assumed through parents, through the whole social system, educational system that influences you from the day you're born. So it's not like you're given this and saying this as a truth, but it's an attitude that affects you and that you pick up without your even knowing it. And then I began to see in my life as a monk a sense of, even in monasticism, in a Thai monastery, for example, this sense of always comparing myself with the other monks. I'm better than they are, they're better than I am. It's insidious. We had to learn to chant this Padimokkha discipline, which is 227 rules in Pali, and you had to before the fifth year as a monk, you were supposed to memorize this whole thing, be able to recite it without looking at the text. And so I found myself wanting to recite the Padimokkha, you know, like faster and better than the Thai monk. Even though idealistically I could see that this was wrong and this was stupid, yet this was such an ingrained way of relating to life, you know, of whatever you're doing, you have to you feel this underlying, even unconscious motivation to be the best, to try to do it better than somebody else. And so I began to see this, because Ajahn Chah was very good at making us look at these conceited attitudes, and these assumptions we were making that we weren't even aware of. Especially if we're operating pretty much on our own terms. When you're living in monastic community, then it mirrors the sense of your self-importance, your conceit, your cultural assumptions. I noticed that I liked living in Asia better than I did in America. Why is that? Why did I prefer Asia? I mean, in America, we had everything, you know, freedom, equality, and comfortable living conditions and efficiency and all the rest. And yet, one felt somehow more at ease. More at home in an Asian country. I lived in, for example, in Malaysia for several years, and in Thailand for many years, and in India. I can say all these countries, I felt there was something in me that felt at ease, even though I was an obvious foreigner in these countries. You know, physically, I was a giant. Compared to the Thai monks, you know, they have pictures of me, with Thai monks, and here I is, huge white man, this little brown man. And obviously, was a foreigner and an alien, but yet psychologically there was an acceptance of life. I found, especially in the Buddhist countries, that didn't bring out this sense of your competitive feelings or the sense that you had to prove yourself. You had to always prove your worth. That wasn't the issue. Like in Buddhist monastery in Thailand, it wasn't the idea of I had to prove that I was I had to prove myself at this monastery. It was a convention set up in order to reflect that very sense of ego and self-concern, selfishness. And so in India, remember one time seeing some, in Calcutta, a woman, a whole family had been sleeping in a bus shelter. Homeless people out on the pavements. Young woman and her husband and several babies. And early in the morning I walked by and this woman smiled at me. And a nice kind of innocent, friendly smile. I had this insight at that time, because my American conditioning said, how can a woman that has to sleep out on the street how can she smile like that? She should be miserable looking. You know, because I'm thinking if for an egotistical person like myself, sleeping out on the streets would make me feel miserable and like I was a really horrible person because I had no worth. I was a homeless person, poor, poverty-stricken. I had no rights. I was a failure. It would bring up all this kind of sense of myself, being like thrown out onto the streets, having to survive in a bus shelter for the night. But there was none of that in this woman's face. It was a friendly, bright greeting. Wasn't asking for anything. And then I had this insight. In India, there is this sense of everybody belongs, no matter what the state condition you're in, whether you're a leper, you don't have any fingers on your hands and your nose is gone, or you're a Maharaja or whatever, even if you're a Westerner, a European, foreigner, you still somehow the question of of having to prove yourself isn't basic there. It isn't an underlying attitude. So that in India, you, no matter, even though you can be quite shocked by some of the poverty and the things that you see there, because we don't allow that to be seen in our own country. And we try to, all those kind of people you hide away because they're shameful. They're disgusting. They make you feel bad. It shouldn't be that way. And we have all these attitudes where in India they're, it's accepted. And it has its bad side. It may be accepting it too much. But also it has its good side in the sense that it's a truth. Everyone has a right to exist, no matter what their condition is. And a leper has just as much right to the street as I do. Or they have as much right to live and breathe and be a human being and survive on this planet as I do. And so I could see that the American conditioning was that I actually, even though I could accept that as an intellectual position, emotionally, I felt I had to prove that I was worthy. My whole life had been an attempt to try to prove to myself that I had a right to be here. And so this is just a reflection from my own experience of life as a and how the various experience do reflect, bring up into consciousness these oftentimes underlying, unstated attitudes that give us a lot of suffering, where we feel alien, we feel unloved, unwanted, rejected, even though to most people's eyes we're loved, we're accepted, we're respectable, we're successful in so many ways, and yet underlying all worldly success, good health, physical beauty, and that can be a feeling that we're worthless. And I see this a lot in people here in the monastery. People that are virtuous, intelligent, good-looking, everything, can feel they're absolutely worthless. And when you ask why, they don't know why. But it's an underlying a kind of emotional attitude they've picked up. Well, in terms of emptiness and selflessness, then we begin to recognize these attitudes as conditions of the mind rather than the conditions that we're grasping, and we begin to let them go rather than just being caught and influenced by these, and till we die, we begin to see a way of relinquishing, renouncing those useless attitudes, so that we do realize emptiness. We do realize selflessness, non-grasping, cessation. So when we contemplate emptiness, for example, we're beginning to realize eternity or infinity or timelessness. Now the conditioned mind is very much time bound. Everything that we're attached to, identified with is a time-bound condition. The body, obviously, gets old. Everything's changing. The seasons change, the day and night, in this continuous process of change going on. Your experiences of life, sometimes you're happy, you're sad, you're successful, you feel like a failure. The whole conditioned realm is in this forever-changing beginning and ending experience through the senses and through the mind. But contemplate, to realize and to recognize eternity, timelessness. And then this is, say, bringing it, when you think about it, it's not logical, isn't it? You're not trying to make a case for eternity, but to recognize it. So the mindfulness, the way of paying attention in the present, this awareness in the present, we begin to realize the deathless or the timeless infinity, unmeasurability. Because even though this is with us, we don't notice. We're so caught up in our views and opinions that come from attachment to thoughts, ideas, reason and logic, modern science, or ethnic cultural attitudes, or certain religious fundamental attitudes, or philosophies, or whatever. These influence how we interpret our experience of life. So, say in the Western mode, say from speaking from my own experience, then these were very much things you just dismissed. Eternity and infinity were, or immortality. These words as were what you know. This happens when you die. That's it's kind of put off to when you die. As I was brought up in the Christian family. So idea of eternity, infinity, immortality, deathlessness, and that deathlessness was never a word. And I never heard that used at all till I became a Buddhist. Immortality was one. But immortality in English means having a physical body, being a person forever and ever. For eternity is time that goes on forever and ever. And so, you know, you realize that it's that time is something that can be contemplated in the present. But if you're already coming from the attitude that when I die, then I'll go to heaven. If I've been good and done all the right things and God doesn't disagree, then I'll go to heaven for eternity. And it sounds, you know, on the level of pleasant perceptions, it can sound very nice. Remember when I was a little boy, it was before television or anything, we used to go to the movies on Saturday afternoons in Seattle. So I loved the movies. And this was what I lived for every Saturday afternoon. Put up with going to school and all the rest. Because Saturday afternoon was when life really became interesting. You go to the movies. I remember asking my mother, I said, you talk about heaven and all that in the afterlife. I said, do they have movies in heaven? And my mother said, no, I don't think they do. And I thought, well, I don't want to go there then. They're a child, isn't it? That's, heaven is had these, in Seattle, had these beautiful cinema halls. Movie theaters, palatial places, you know, for a child, with gilded balustrades and all kinds of silk hangings and whatnot, and grand movie theaters in the 1940s, in a place like Seattle. And it was like you go in and you can be entertained, thrilled, see all these wonderful things for that period of time. That's heaven. Now I think if they show movies in heaven, I wouldn't want to go there. But I think the most difficult realization is the present moment, because this is because what influences us in the present is usually in emotional, physical, and it's habitual. So we have to deal with these habits always in the present, and these habits are always the habits are things that are always taking us into the past or the future. Like to sustain awareness in the present moment, it's not easy to do unless you're really interested in something that's going on where you can kind of that holds your attention. But if there's nothing holding your attention in the present, what happens? Your mind wanders all over the place. Like with meditation, isn't it? You're teaching meditation to people, and you're trying to encourage them to stay awake and be fully present, fully awake and aware in the present moment. And that's one of the most difficult things that people have been asked to do, because they're always they're not programmed for that. In fact, it is an actual deprogramming of the habit tendencies. That's why it can seem so difficult at first, because you're actually, by doing that, you're learning how to remove all the heavy programming that you've acquired in your life. Because we tend to look at it in terms of worldly values, it doesn't look like it's worth anything. Remember, people saying, what a waste of time meditation is, watching your belly button. Yogis in India, they just sit and meditate on their navels. We used to laugh. I remember as children, we used to think that was hilarious. You have all the useless and stupid things to do with your life, sit around under a tree and meditate on your navel. Your breath isn't, navel or breath. But when you're contemplating, when you're developing that state of awareness, a sustained attentiveness in the present, then you begin to see it's something very worthwhile developing. But in terms of worldly aims and values, it's useless and wasting your time. You could be studying French, or taking a night course, or watching the television, or playing golf, doing But to sit around watching your breath or contemplating your navel. But in terms of training the mind, isn't it? Because that's what we have in our societies, don't train us, don't encourage that kind of mental development. And so our minds tend to just accumulate. We become creatures of habit. We get overburdened with ideas and thoughts. We become obsessed with ourselves and our worth or worthlessness. And we endlessly create problems around ourselves and the people we're living with and the places we're in. Because there's always something wrong, always something inadequate about myself or somebody else or the situation. And then wherever you are, isn't it, in your own house, with whoever you're living with, there's always something wrong with it. Remember when we moved to Chithurst years ago in 79, Chithurst house was this derelict house. And it was the first time I'd ever really been able to see what a, that at one time it was a really finely made house. It was built in the early 1860s. And because it was in such derelict state, we had to kind of strip a lot of it and take the plaster and dry rot. And I began to observe that this house in the beginning, back in 1860, had all the very best materials in it, made of stone, thick joists and beams and beautiful joinery on the windows and doors, and everything was, the Victorian technology was very interesting. I've never seen anything like that. How they collected rainwater and slate tanks in the attics and a whole lot. It's fascinating to observe. And I contemplated, here is a house built in 1860, stone house. Stone has a sense of eternity, doesn't it? It's not like in Seattle, we all have wooden houses. Wooden houses don't have that sense of lasting forever. Stone, to me, meant that, you know, it was a hard substance that would last forever. And yet, by 1979, that house was ready to fall, was ready to cave in. And we even observed that the stone was crumbling. There were wasps and different kinds of insects that burrow into sandstone, and part of it would just come off in chunks. And then this dry rot, the wooden structures inside, under the plaster, between the bricks and so forth. There's this hideous thing called dry rot. It crept in. It's like some awful, ugly monster. That it can sends its spores even through brick and stonework. As soon as it senses there's some wood someplace, it can go right, send it right through these impenetrable substances like stone and brick. It's like an invincible evil force, dry rot. We had this sense of this. Even Ajahn Sajito, with his artistic temperament, drew a picture of the dry rot deva, he called it. And it was the most ugly, ugly kind of creature. And then in the cellar, in the basement of Chittor's house, were all these huge, hideous flowers of dry rot fungi. Flowers, and they were the most ghastly looking things. Disgusting kind of thing, and that yet this kind of thing that didn't have much substance to it could actually seep through, go through stone and brick to any wooden piece underneath the plaster in that house and destroy it, completely destroy the wood. So then, you know, I keep thinking that these are, you know, you build a house. You know, the people that built Chittor's house in 1860 were going to build this fine house, elegant style, you know, high ceilings and arched doorways and all the rest. And then we'll have this beautiful house to live in. But then you read the history of Chittor's house. They didn't live in it very long. They had to sell it and went to... Pretty soon, by 1979, it was the roof was caving in, the floor was falling into the cellar, and so forth. And so you contemplated how, you know, how impermanent, and that once you do something, you get it to its peak, like this temple, and it'll be built up. You know, it'll be finished, and then what will it do? It'll decay. That's just the law of nature. It'll reach its peak, and the moment then you kind of it reaches its peak, it's finished, you say, this is it, no more has to be done. And we built it in a way that is a low maintenance. We don't like to work. We don't spend our life taking care of a temple. Low maintenance, we build up, and then, you know, then it'll sustain itself in that perfect state. Immediately it starts decaying. So, I mean, this is just the conditioned world is like this. You have to keep always having to clean, to prop it up, to renew, to refurbish, to repair, because the conditioned realm is not a sustainable state. It can't it doesn't have anything that lasts in it. So the time-bound conditions are seen as just that. And we begin to break our identity, let go of our identity with the time-bound conditions of the body, the thoughts, the emotions, the habits of the mind. Doesn't mean we're in a state of denial or rejection, but you see something, you really see it and know it for what it is, then it's insight, it's profound kind of insightful knowing the truth. It's not just adopting a Buddhist attitude towards the conditioned realm. We're not asking you to do that, just to have form some kind of Buddhist idea about the world and operate from that. But to penetrate into the way things are for that direct kind of wisdom and knowledge and understanding of Dhamma, in which you can let go of the sense of yourself and let go of the world and not try to hang on, hold on, identify the world and try to sustain something that you can't sustain. Because in terms of this realization, then you can, when you realize the non-grasping, the deathless, or begin to get a sense for the measureless, the infinite, the timeless, the eternal. And it's not a blank, is it? It's not annihilation. It's not a rejection of the world or the conditions of the world or the body or anything. But it is an understanding and seeing things as they are in context, in time, in place, in seeing it as it really is, rather than through a filter of greed or hatred or delusion. And this is the potential that we all have as human beings. I mean, this is possible for us. We can do this. This isn't asking you. I mean, this isn't just a theory, intellectual theory that sounds great, but it is something that we can do. We don't need even special equipment. You don't need a computer. You don't need a microscope or telescope. Any electronic equipment or you don't even need to be educated. You can be illiterate. Because you've got it all here. What you're looking at is the way it is, the body, this body, the way your mind is. What, no matter how, what way your mind is, no matter how intelligent your thoughts or how stupid your thoughts might be, is not the issue anymore. It's using wisdom rather than trying to figure it out intelligently with reason and logic. It's intuitive. It's an opening the mind to the universe rather than trying to fit the universe into the little perceptions that you've acquired through your education. And that's one of the kind of images of the foolish creature, isn't it? Where you're trying to interpret the universe in terms of very mediocre perceptions, concepts. Trying to understand everything through just a dualistic logic. Because if you do that, then you end up with either eternalism, Well, you think you want to think in terms of positive, be a positive thinker, or you're annihilationist. Those are the two extremes. Or you can be a fence-sitter. Oh, I don't really know. Not bother to think about the future in terms of except maybe your next holiday or what you're going to, your next job or your next partner or something. But one can just get so mesmerized and involved with the things around one, with the objects and conditions that, and in the modern life, we have an unlimited supply of distractions. In the wintertime, you know, and you think, here in Britain, probably in the wintertime, say 100 years or so ago, people didn't really have much to do. It's too cold to go outside, you stayed in, you learned how to knit, crochet, embroider, work out crossword puzzles, do things, entertain each other. People used to read to each other. Now we can, you know, we can, wintertime, go on holiday, we've got television, we've got all ways of just distracting ourselves from having to look at anything very closely or having to work through boredom. Having to sit still and having to just bear with an overactive mind and obsessive emotional habits and so forth, because we can always just drift around, go on to the next thing. So this is one reason why meditation has become increasingly regarded, respected in Britain. There's a much more interest now in meditation, in people willing to train themselves to sit still and to awaken and observe, because they see that even the people come here on a weekend for a weekend retreat, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, to sit still. Watch their breath and contemplate their navels. They could be out having a good time. They'll sit there with their knees aching, their backs aching, their minds going berserk. And then thank you at the end of it. Thank you, Ajahn Sumedho. But also there's something in us that realizes that this is something we need to learn how to do, to learn how to be still, how to listen to the silence, how to relax inwardly without, you know, how to be aware, sustain attention in the present without trying to hold our attention to something exciting or interesting. And this is a different way of training, a different way of using the mind than say anything that has been developed so far in the West. Because intuitively, no, this is what we need to do. Because we know in a country like this where we can pretty much get what we want in terms of material things, and we can go to, you know, televisions, and we can have, you know, movies 24 hours a day. And they have these cable channels and so forth. And, you know, if I was still 7 or 8 years old. But you outgrow that, you know, that heaven is heaven, you know, where you get tired of too many movies. Too much excitement is boring. You have to keep boosting it up with drugs now, ecstasy and all these other things, and ways of attempting to create, you know, just the most exciting thing you can ever experience. And yet, what does it do? You know, it gets you into a high state, but then you drop, isn't it? I hear people that do that, and they drop into a depressed state very quickly. It's like the higher you go, the lower you fall. So in terms of meditation, what you're really learning to find a balanced, sustainable state in the present that isn't dependent on things being interesting or pleasant or beautiful, pleasing to you, but you begin to awaken to the deathless reality. In which you're no longer, you can break your identity, your attachment to the death-bound conditions of your body and conditions of your mind. So that's what liberation is. Ultimate freedom, nibbana. Oftentimes they say the highest happiness is nibbana. And then we think, oh, nibbana is probably higher than ecstasy. But to realize nibbana means that you have to let go of ecstasy. Or heroin, or any of those. And even let go of just boredom and restlessness and all the things that come up. When you're sitting in a meditation hall, and then things will come up into consciousness, like anger and resentment and a lot of ugly, nasty emotions will suddenly kind of rise up into consciousness in a meditation. But you're learning, rather than to fight and resist, you're learning how to relinquish, let go of those conditions. So it's as I said before, it's a deprogramming of the mind. You're learning to free your mind, liberate your mind from the negative habits you've acquired, the emotional patterns that one gets stuck with in life, more and more through meditating the right way and developing the right attitude, then these are liberated from you through conscious awareness of them, in rather than judging them as personal problems, you're looking at them in terms of conditions ceasing. You're letting them go. So at first, that's why some of you find your beginning meditation somewhat, or even after several years, sometimes nothing really, the real repressed negativity doesn't arise with some people till several years later, and then it all kind of explodes up. And they think, oh, God, I used to have such blissful states, now as soon as I sit down, well, my mind goes crazy. That's fine. It is the beginning to, you know, your way of seeing it, of relating to that craziness or that ugliness in a way that you're liberating your mind rather than conditioning it with fear or resentment, resistance. So that this is where they the emptiness, non-attachment, we realize this. And we let go of our thinking mind, our logical mind. It doesn't mean we deny it or reject it, but we're no longer dependent on the extremes of the conditioned realm. Our identity has been broken. We're freed from the bondage to desire and to fear. So I offer this as a reflection for you this Sunday afternoon. We can have a break. Obviously, the survey they're setting up a tea for us. You're invited to have tea. And then in 20 minutes or so, of those who are interested, we can reassemble, and I will open up the remaining time for questions.